Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You probably didn't vote in yesterday's election. Primary elections in King, Pierce, Nahomish County, and the turnout was puny.
What the hell is going on with our lack of engagement at the voting booth?
Good question, State Senator Reuven Carlisle. Let's find out what's going on with KUOW political reporter Amy Radel and Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas. Good to see you both.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Amy, who might be the next mayor of Seattle?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's going to be a woman.
Yes. Tell us more.
Well, we saw Jenny Durkin take a solid lead last night with about 30% of the votes counted so far. Obviously, just the initial results. We're going to have more votes coming out all week. And then second, Carrie Moon. And then Nikita Oliver, just not less than 1,500 votes behind her. And finally, former state legislator Jessen Farrell in fourth place. So all over the map. But all women, and except for Representative Farrell, all first-time candidates.
So many votes still to be counted. CR, do you think we're in recount territory?
I think some of these races could flip. We've seen in the past where a margin even larger than what Nikita Oliver and Carrie Moon have now did flip. So about half the votes have been counted. The rest will be counted over the course of this week. You could see some movement. I mean, Jenny Durkin is so far ahead, there's not going to be movement on her part of the race. But you could see a Nikita Oliver overtake Carrie Moon, and it could be Durkin Oliver come the fall.
So we're thinking Durkin, yes, Oliver, Moon, Farrell are all maybes, not even Farrell.
Not sure. It's a long shot for
long shot.
I think Farrell is pretty much at it at this point.
Okay.
Nikita has a chance. You know, what we've seen over the past several election cycles is that the later you vote, typically the younger and the more progressive and the more radical you are. So
really, why is that?
They just end up being the last to vote. You could say they're the flakiest, and so they don't get around to it until the very end. So they count votes as they come in. So the votes that haven't been counted yet are the votes that came in last. So that's Nikita's hope, if you will, for overtaking Carrie Moon. I mean, obviously, she does well with that sort of radical leftist coalition. That is her base. So she has a chance with later voters to overtake it.
So not Hasegawa, not Mike McGinn, someone who's done this job, and as you said, Amy, lost to a bunch of first-timers.
That's right. And McGinn was second in the poll that we did several weeks ago. You know, he had the name recognition of his time in the mayor's office. So when we did that poll, it was Durkin and McGinn were the two front runners. So he clearly lost ground in the course of the race, or these other new candidates gained it and gained the momentum.
So Durkin got more votes than anyone else, but does that mean she is the favorite in November, CR?
I think it is. I mean, listen, she cobbled together the coalition you typically cobble together to win this kind of position in Seattle. I mean, labor, environmentalists, Democrats, the downtown business community, I mean, checked all those boxes. And I think those constituencies are only going to grow for her as you get to November. She's got the most money. She's got the most kind of endorsements in terms of, you know, the big names in politics, the Seattle Times. And I just don't see her momentum shifting as you go into November, whether it's Nikita Oliver or Carrie Moon.
Well, the other theory, Amy, would be that there might be a not Durkin, you know, group of votes, right?
Absolutely. There's been speculation that all of the candidates will unite behind whoever is in second place, Carrie Moon or Nikita Oliver, because it was a friendly, respectful primary as the candidates talked about their admiration for each other, Carrie Moon and Nikita Oliver specifically. So they could coalesce, you know, who does that bring in? And also, Jenny Durkin has, you know, what some people see as a great asset in her family history of her father's political career and her time as U.S. attorney. But for some people in Seattle, labels like establishment, old guard, business supported, corporate backed, these are going to be things that she has to sort of overcome or show that she really means for that to just be one piece of bringing people together is how she often, you know, kind of counters that.
I think the only one that could beat Jenny Durkin would be a woman. And I think it's clear this has been the year of the woman. I mean, as Amy pointed out, the top four finishers were women. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that Mike McGinn and Bob Hasegawa just didn't fare well. I think if Mike had made it through and it was a Jenny Durkin Mike McGinn race, I think it would be over right before it began.
Seattle hasn't had a woman as mayor in almost 100 years. What do you think has changed?
Well, it's...
Or is it just the current crop of candidates?
I think, you know, it's interesting because women have been, in a lot of ways, behind the scenes leading Seattle for years. You know, the two deputy mayors right now are women. We've had a lot of female deputy mayors. We've had a lot of female cabinet members. We have a female chief of police. We've had female majorities on the city council. We've had female council presidents. I mean, it's a bit of a surprise it's taken this long to have the sort of second woman in Seattle history. Partly it's been an accident. You know, some of the best chance women, if you will, chose not to run in the past. Sally Clark, she was a council president. Martha Cho, she was a former council president. Even Maud Dodon, who was a former deputy mayor, now the head of the chamber, she had been talked about a couple years ago. So none of them have jumped in, and I think the time is just, you know, it's long overdue, and it's finally now that I think the women are getting their moment in this race.
So, as I said, most people didn't vote. Maybe a lot of people haven't paid any attention. The one candidate we know who will be getting through in November is Jenny Durkin. Amy, what should we know about her if we haven't been paying attention because it's 90 degrees or whatever it is?
That's right. And she'll be, you know, having to take this opportunity to introduce herself to people who haven't been paying attention or who are new arrivals in Seattle and haven't heard her name or her father's name. You know, I spoke to someone last night who came as who volunteered for Durkin because she got involved in politics around United Farm Workers organizing years ago. And they went to the legislature and Jenny Durkin's father turned out to be the champion on that issue, helping them roll back what they said was some negative legislation. So you have these people who have the sense of history. And then, yeah, the people who didn't even vote this time around. And, you know, talking to State Senator Reuben Carlisle is kind of interesting because didn't we have all this activist energy coming out of November? And now, just a few months later, we're at, you know, kind of like on par or record low turnout.
Yes. In case you didn't hear at the very top, this is a little bit more of State Senator Reuben Carlisle going off on our turnout.
What the hell is going on with our lack of engagement at the voting booth?
Well, it's not really down from historical levels. I mean, we'll have about 35% turnout. That's about standard for this kind of cycle, a primary in this cycle. Partly the problem is we keep moving this thing earlier and earlier. I mean, it used to be after Labor Day we voted, and then they pushed it forward so it was kind of mid-August, and now it's the first week of August. So it's dead in the center of summer, which makes it hard.
So Seattle mayors are almost never women until now. They're almost always Irish-American in recent memory. Jenny Durkin grew up Irish Catholic. I'm not sure about all her field of competitors. Irish-American Mike McGinn, not going to go through. Let's turn to some other things that happened outside of Seattle. We had the King County proposed tax, sales tax for the arts. Arts and culture, that's losing pretty significantly. That's defeated, we're pretty sure?
I think it's pretty clear, yeah. It's down 10 percentage points, and I see it probably doing worse as even more ballots get counted.
Amy, why do you think the King County arts tax lost?
I think this is a really interesting turning point for, you know, a constituency that has always said yes to requests like this. And suddenly, especially in this election, I felt like more left political candidates and office holders here really started to push on the idea of regressive taxes and that you're contributing to displacement of people when you pass these sales and property tax increases. And so we really have to be more skeptical. So I think that kind of hit home for some people who normally would say, hey, for me personally, I love the idea. I'm happy to pay this tax because I love the arts.
I agree that was probably the dynamic that dictated the outcome. I was a bit surprised. I didn't think it would be like this overwhelming victory, but I thought, you know, they probably squeak it out. I mean, they had a ton of money. There was no organized opposition. They didn't raise any money. And the dollar amount, though it was a regressive tax, it was very low. It was $30 a year for the average household. So not a big lift. But I think as the campaign went on, it looked less appealing. You know, as we got to know more about this ballot measure, it was clear it was pretty top heavy. That is to say, the arts organizations that were getting funded were the Seattle Opera, the Seattle Symphony, the ballet.
Woodland Park Zoo.
It felt pretty 1%-y, you know, the beneficiaries. Now, there were a number of groups, 350 in all, that were going to sort of get money, but that these big arts organizations were going to kind of make out, if you will, on a regressive tax levy at a time when it's clear there are higher priorities when you talk to voters. I mean, transportation and education and homelessness, that this just didn't feel right.
An interesting story statewide, and it's gotten some national attention, is that if the Democrats can win the 45th District Senate seat, East Side, they'll have majorities in the House and the Senate and the governor. And Amy, how's that going?
Sounds like it's promising for the Democrat in that race with these just initial results.
Yeah, Monica Dhingra and Jinjiang Anglin, the two that are running, newcomers. You know, it's a district that's long been held by a Republican, the state Senate seat, but it's been moving much more blue over the years. In fact, the two House seats that are in the same district are held by Democrats. Trump got trounced in that district 2-1. So it's like many East Side districts. In fact, it's the last holdout in the East Side that still has a Republican. So there's a headwind for whoever has an R behind their name. And the Democrat came out, 8 percentage points ahead. That's a strong showing. Now, they will both go on to November.
Yes.
But what this was about was showing who had strength, you know, in this primary. And it's going to be an uphill battle for that Republican. I can tell you it was already scheduled to be the most expensive legislative race in Washington state history, topping out at $10 million. That is more than most congressional races.
Mm-hmm.
And members of Congress, let's just remember, run the country.
Yeah.
Members of a state delegation run a tiny little thing. So it's the magnitude here ought to be noted. And I think after the Democrat won so handily, Republicans are really going to pour in money to this race because it is the balance of power. Republicans hold a one-seat majority in the state House. If they lose this, they lose that majority. And as you say, Inslee will have both houses and kind of a run of the table, if you will, for his agenda.
State Senate
and House and governorship, if that happens.
This, yes.
And yeah, that's one question we'll be asking is what would the Democrats do with that extra majority if that came through? So that's about our time. I mean, we always hear from people, how did you not talk about the so-and-so? I mean, you had John Grant losing to Teresa Mosqueda in the open Seattle City Council race. I thought it was interesting that some people didn't put Carrie Moon in their, you know, top gonna get through list. She got endorsed by the stranger. And, you know, maybe that was a fact. It was all kind of things we could, you know, sort of get at. Anything you really want to talk about the vote that has been unsung? Amy Radel.
I saw David Rolfe, the labor leader. He endorsed Jenny Durkin. He came to her gathering, but he said it could be a toss-up in terms of who is in second place because Nikita Oliver had such a great kind of field operation. Carrie Moon had the stranger endorsement. Those both could, you know, do well in the later returns.
C.R. Douglas.
On whole, it felt kind of status quo-y. I mean, if you look at some of the special legislative districts, as there were only a handful on the ballot, you know, some of the Democrats did well over in the 45th, as we talked about. Republicans can point to some success in some South Puget Sound area districts. So you could say it's sort of a wash. And I would say in Seattle politics, the sort of divide we have between the kind of the establishment and the radical left was sort of a draw. I mean, you had obviously Jenny Durkin as a representative of that establishment, if you will, doing well. But Nikita Oliver, you know, with a great showing. I mean, Jonathan Grant didn't win, but he likely will come in second. We'll see how the votes play out. So, you know, the radical left can point to some success in this election, and so can the quote unquote, you know, mainstream liberals.
The ballots will be, so many as there are, the ballots will be counted for several days, results officially certified in mid-August and general election November 7th. Amy Radel, KOW political reporter, C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 News. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KOW's The Record, continuing in a moment. KUOW's The Record. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. In less than a week this July, two young black men were shot to death next to Rainier Playfield in Seattle's Columbia City neighborhood. Reporter Ann Dornfeld from KUOW's race and equity team went to 38th and Oregon to meet a man who knew both of the victims and who knows that park very well.
For Elijah Brown, Rainier Community Center and Playfield is the safest, most dangerous place. Brown is 22. He lives just up the street. In grade school, he tagged along with his older brother to the center's teen program.
Going bowling every Wednesday, or a cooking class every Tuesday or Thursday.
This is the field where he played football, the court where he won a basketball championship, and the site of his first internship. It's also the block where he watched a man get shot to death. Brown was 9 years old.
And in the third grade, it doesn't register. It's like you're living a movie. I was more in shock at that specific time. And then as years, went on and all the shootings continued to happen, I just realized that's what's happening.
Brown points to the street where he and his friends were walking home from middle school when a man riding by in a car pointed a gun at them. Over there is the football field where he and the rest of his team hit the deck as shots rang out around them.
And then they're like, they're shooting. And we were on the ground for about 5 minutes, just waiting.
Despite the violence, Brown kept coming to Rainier Community Center. There was the late night basketball gym on Fridays, free classes, a recording studio, and field trips to places he and his friends had never been.
There was a year we went camping. Remember making chili mac, over the fire. And I went fishing before. You don't hear about community centers taking their teens fishing anymore. Getting more accustomed to new things and understanding the world's a lot bigger than basketball rapping, being in the streets.
Brown says this community center kept a lot of kids he knew out of trouble and out of the gangs that have long claimed these streets. But over time, he says, the teen program changed. There was new staff and new policies, classes he and his friends just weren't into. The community center started charging $2 for the Friday late night open gym and making teens show ID to prove they were between 13 and 19.
There was little kids that would come with their older siblings and then now they couldn't come. Then how are you going to keep them off the streets if you make all these rules and make it hard for them to get away from all that?
Brown says he stopped coming as much. His friends did too. One of those friends was Stephen Stewart.
We went to elementary together. We're in the teen programs, high school together a little bit.
We're standing now at a memorial to Stewart at Rainier Playfield. He was shot and killed here July 14th. Stewart was gunned down as he was visiting a memorial to Shamar Curry, who had been killed here just days before. Brown says the community center had been a lifeline for Stewart.
He was somebody who was involved in the gangs. He had that pressure on him from the streets to be just like his dad.
Stewart's dad was named Stephen too. His son became Lil Steph.
So when his dad was killed, his involvement got more. He really was a good-hearted person. He really was a good person overall, but the pressure that the streets put on him.
Stewart seemed to have turned a page in life. He was staying out of trouble, and he had added reason to. He now had a young daughter, about the same age as Brown's son.
We were talking the other day, talking about how we became fathers and how we can't ever leave them. And so when you see something like this, he just couldn't ever get past it.
Inside the community center is another man mourning the loss of both young men who were just killed across the street. Andre Franklin grew up with Shamar Curry, and Franklin directed the teen program that meant so much to Stewart and Brown. He now runs teen programs at other Seattle community centers, but he remained close with Stewart.
Often he would tell me, I was like his dad. I went to his graduations and, just been involved with him throughout the years and trying to guide him in the right direction and give him the resources that he needed to be successful.
Franklin says programs are only as strong as the relationships they create between kids and adults, and only as strong as the community's commitment to giving young people what they need.
Do you really want my son to have the same opportunities as your son? That's the question. People say, yeah, but when it comes down to allocating resources and what school they're going to put their kids into and providing opportunities, it doesn't really happen like that.
Back outside the center, Elijah Brown runs into friends he grew up with in the teen program. They live all over now. They're coming back to see each other and the community center staff and to remember Stephen Stewart.
What's up? How you doing?
Staying out the way.
How you doing, man?
Good.
Trying to be safe, man. That's all.
Yeah. That's how we all are.
Okay. Yeah. It's starting to get back like the old Seattle.
The old Seattle. where this park that's a second home for young people, a place to learn and grow, is also where they know they or their friends or family might one day get shot. That's hard to swallow for a lot of new residents to Columbia City, folks with money who can afford housing in this rapidly gentrifying neighborhood. Brown sees them post in the neighborhood Facebook group about the need for more police.
When I hear somebody in the group say, "What's happening to our neighborhood?" And I just want to be, don't you think that's what we were asking too?
While we've been out here, we've seen the cops drive by half a dozen times, a response to the recent shootings. Brown says that'll tamp down violence for a while, but not for long.
All I really can say is just a lot of involvement with the youth and not really just the police patrolling. Helping them find ways to get them out the street instead of just keeping them there and trying to just lock them up, because that's the easiest thing to do.
Brown says growing up in this community center helped him learn what he's good at and discover the world beyond this neighborhood. He's out of work right now. He was working at a soup factory, but then he hurt his back. Brown still comes down to the community center all the time.
Rainier is like just my favorite place. I come down here to write. It's, you know, lets me continue to be who I am. That's why I just love this place.
The safest and most dangerous place. In Columbia City, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
My next guest knows about the risks young men of color can face in Southeast Seattle. Marty Jackson works with the Seattle Youth Violence Prevention Initiative, helping young men find work and stay out of gang life. She was working with Stephen Stewart right before he was shot and killed in Columbia City.
When it comes to the loss of a young person that you knew, it has a huge impact, not just on me, but all of the people who worked with this young man and the potential that he had, and to think about how often you talk to the young person and was there anything that you could have done or said? And a lot of the times, you know, there isn't.
Is there something I could have done or said? Marty Jackson asks herself that a lot. And she still wonders, could she have done something different herself for one young man in particular, her son, who joined a gang even as she was working to keep other boys and young men out of gang life?
I don't think that you could ever prepare for the impact that that has. I think, although knowing what being gang involved looks like and working with young people who are involved, I don't think I really knew fully why all young people joined gangs or what led them to that point. And I think that doing this work and doing it for some time and doing everything that you can to change that trajectory for your own kid, just hoping that that wouldn't be something that they would choose, I think has had a bigger impact. When I think about everything I did from when my son was a kid, you know, as a baby growing up, and knowing what was out there and wanting to make sure that he had all of the opportunities afforded to him, thinking that that would prevent him from getting involved in a gang.
Why were you wrong about that? What was going on?
I think that as a parent and kind of somewhat removed, just because I wasn't, you know, involved in gangs. However, you know, I did have brothers who were, and so I knew what it looked like. I don't think I really understood the disconnect that happens for young people, particularly young men of color.
What disconnect is that?
The disconnect from their community, sometimes from their family. I always say perception is reality. And so as a mother raising your kid and thinking, okay, and put you in private school at a young age, you know, thinking that, okay, I want to make sure that you get all of the opportunities afforded to you. And I was going to do whatever it took to ensure that he got the educational opportunities he needed to get ahead, involving him in other pro-social activities. He was in sports. And so his father was around. I was around. My family was around. He had uncles, aunts, big family. And so you think that you keep them involved and engaged in positive activities in a positive environment, well, there's going to be a positive outcome. And for my son growing up, and no different than me growing up in a household where like it was normal for you to go to public meetings, and there were task force and to help out with, you know, different public officials in terms of candidacy and thinking about the campaigns and all of the things that I volunteered for as a young person, I thought about my own experience and feeling disconnected and not really understanding why my parents did what they did. And so I relate that to my son, the disconnect in thinking that because you do all of these things, that his perception is the same as yours. And it wasn't.
What was your son's perception?
And his perception, it was a lot of pressure to be in a family like this. And when I say, I mean, all of my brothers and sisters are all involved in the community. Seeing us work with young people and seeing us, you know, engaging with the community in a lot of different ways, whether it was a peace rally or, you know, just other pro-social community block parties, all of these things he grew up in. And I think back and I think I've never really asked him how he felt or how connected he felt to the work that I was doing and that my family was doing. And so if never asked, you make the assumption that his perception is the same as yours.
Is it like being a preacher's son or daughter that you know, parents
are
the pillar of the community?
Absolutely. I would say similar, definitely parallel to that. And I think that it happens with a lot of community activists and community organizers. I think the pressure of what you were supposed to be and how you were supposed to act because of your parents and not feeling like you have a voice caused them to be rebellious.
This is relatable to so many parents, right? Here you have these great intentions. And as I said, you work with young people. You're at the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative. How does what you learned with your own son, how does that change and inform the work you do with young people in Seattle today?
Well, I think I always tell people my best training has been the experience I have with my son. I think he's taught me more than any training, any book, any manual. I grew up in a household where it was very dictator-ish. And so, you know, you had a tremendous amount of respect for your parents. And when they spoke and told you to do something, you responded and did it without hesitation. And I think that growing up in a household where, you know, that was traditionally kind of how you approach things, my son really taught me how to listen. It was a very humbling experience to hear what his perception was and how disconnected he felt from his family, from, you know, his parents. You know, as a parent, you think, why didn't I pick that up? Why didn't I see that? And so really thinking about in different ways, what's common across the board is I think about my experience and I think about how no kid is exempt. Like it isn't always the kid who didn't have parent support or didn't have his father in his life. Sometimes it's that social emotional connection to family members. If you can't find that connection with anyone else in your family, well, it can lead you somewhere else. And that's what happened to him. It led him to other young men who felt the same. And unfortunately, it led to other negative activity in a negative environment, but really from a positive intent around what he was looking for.
So now, Marty, as you listen before you teach, it sounds like, what are you hearing the kids of Southeast Seattle saying about what they need, especially right now over the summertime? Things get more hot and loose and violent over the summer, don't they?
Well, I think a lot of people feel, young people feel invisible. I don't think that young people, a lot of young people and the young people we're talking about who might be gang involved or might be court involved, feel like they have a voice in their community. And I think it's really creating opportunities, although, you know, services help, but I think it's first creating opportunities for young people to be acknowledged. And I mean the most marginalized young people, I mean the most vulnerable young people in our neighborhoods, and really thinking about how do we contribute to that? Do you know, in your neighborhood, as you're walking by young people, do you say hi to them? Do you ask them their names? I don't know that that happens a lot in our neighborhood. And I think sometimes because of fear, you know, people walk by and are a bit cautious because of a lot of the media, negative media that's been portrayed in the Southeast neighborhoods. And growing up in that neighborhood, and anybody else who's grown up in the neighborhood, all of us know that there are way more positive assets in the community that would overshadow if people knew all of the negative incidents that have happened in the neighborhood.
Is this especially an issue in Southeast Seattle where there's gentrification and new people coming into the neighborhood, or could we be talking about any place?
I would say that. I would say that gentrification plays a role. I think that when you have people moving into the neighborhood and they're not familiar with the culture, all they've really heard is a lot of the negative media coverage that happens in the Southeast, particularly the Rainier Beach neighborhood. And so not knowing all of the assets or finding out, you know, what's great about the neighborhood, and I mean specifically regarding the young people and the people, the residents who've been there for a long time, I think there's a misconception. And I think that you don't necessarily, if you don't know where to go or if you don't know who to talk to, you know, there's this very negative perception of Southeast. And I think that's what perpetuates fear, and fear perpetuates this disconnect between young people and adults.
What are the solutions you're seeing? What works?
It starts with relationship building. What has to happen is we have to make our young people feel connected again. And that comes with acknowledgement first. It comes with giving them a voice. And once they do find their voice and they start to speak up, that we listen and we really hear what young people need.
That's Marty Jackson, Southeast Network Coordinator for the Seattle Youth Violence Prevention Initiative. You're listening to The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle, news and information. A lot more to come. We've got U.S. Senator Patty Murray reaching across the aisle on health care. We're going to meet a couple of hydro drivers who are going to be going fast and loud this weekend, so stay tuned. KUOW, 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Well, I sure hope you like this noise. Because you're going to be hearing it again this weekend. Hydroplane races on Lake Washington. They've been part of Seafair since 1951. This weekend, teammates Brent Hall and Jerry Hopp will be going, what, 140 miles an hour?
No, I think we're probably more 155, maybe 160 if the water isn't too rough.
Jerry, you've been called the world's fastest grandpa. Do you accept that title?
I earned it.
You had a world record.
Yes, I set three world records. American Powerboat Association is the organization that runs the hydroplanes and racing across the U.S. They have five different records in our class, and I hold three of them.
Brent, you didn't even start racing until you were 36 years old. How did you get into a boat?
You know, it's really funny because was a fan and had the chance to crew for Harold Mills, and I got really good at the marketing side of it, and he retired. So I was like, well, gosh, I want to do something with this, so maybe I'll do a fundraiser for kids, get in the boat, and see what happens. And now we're here.
Should I know Harold Mills? Is he one of the greats?
He is definitely an up-and-coming first African-American to win a trophy at Seafair, so one of my mentors.
Oh, is race a factor one way or the other in hydro? I don't think of a black hydroplane drivers when I think of, you know, the few I know.
Sure. He's definitely the first in his blaze trails, but no, that's not what it's about. It's about your skills and everything, but definitely happen to be black, and you know, obviously if there's kids out there that aspire to it, hope that they see me and go, wow, maybe someday I could do that.
So Brent started at age 36. Jerry, you were you were a little kid. I was just talking yesterday to this writer named Knute Berger, who we know and love here, who was saying that he would drag around a wooden hydroplane boat behind his bike when he was a kid. And then I heard you did the exact same thing.
Yes, I did. And even Chip Hanauer started out that way, too.
Chip Hanauer, I know.
I had a bike. I was 8 years old, lived in South Park, pulling a boat around the manhole covers and went through a mud puddle. And there was a rock in the mud puddle. The bicycle stopped and I didn't. I land on my head, get 8 stitches in my right eyebrow. And I must have known at that time that I'm already bleeding for the sport, so I might as well continue.
I'm already going to get injured. I might as well drive a hydro. And you were going to Sea Fair when you were a little kid, Brent?
Oh, yeah. Every year. We'd watch it a lot from our deck, so that was where I kind of got my start. And my mom
grew up on Mercer Island.
Absolutely. Yeah. My mom's a big fan and would have parties every year, and that was the focal point, the hydroplane races.
And she told you could not be a Blue Angels pilot, so...
But no, actually, she said, go do it, follow your dreams.
Oh, my God.
And, she's just been a big fan and has always...
My mom wouldn't let me do either one, but I wonder where the limit is.
My mom is crazy and in a good way.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, will you put us in that cockpit with you? I mean, like I said, this is how it sounds to us and all that. What does it sound like to you in there?
We wear a helmet. And we have headphones in there because we have radio communications shipped ashore, as it were.
What are you talking about?
Pardon?
What are you talking about when you're having radio communications?
We tell jokes and
no, mostly the start.
Yeah.
Counting down the start. We start with a 5-minute clock, and you want to be at the start finish line at zero when the clock hits zero. So you've got somebody counting down because you're pretty busy and can't look over to the shore to see the clock. And then once the race starts, it's okay, you're a rooster tail ahead of this guy or one boat length ahead of that guy, and you can't move over now, or you know, it's not,
you don't want to get in the rooster tail, right? Absolutely. That I know.
Oh, that's not good. When your windshield turns dark green, that's bad.
Yep. Has this happened to each of you?
Yes, it has.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that life-threatening? I mean, what is that like to be? So the rooster tail, that's the water being ejected behind the boats. That's a lot of water, and that hits you and what?
Number one, you can't see, and you're trying to figure out what direction to go. There's other boats that might be behind you or beside you, so you want to make sure you keep your trail. And one of the tips that I've learned from both Jerry and Harold is you look for the black. So if you see black in the water, even though there's spray over you, then you know you're still in clean water. But if it's all white, you're probably in a rooster tail, and you might be going up it.
Yes, that is the important part, but the idea is to be out in front and let the other guy care about that.
Right. Why would you be in anybody else's rooster tail?
Right.
You're winning.
What's up with this picture?
So that's how it sounds and maybe how it wrecks. How does it feel?
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to be in that boat going 150 whatever?
You know, and Jerry's been doing it for years, so it's kind of old hat for him. But for me, you know, it's really, there's a lot of concentration. I was teasing a little bit, but there's a lot of strategy. You know, when I was talking about Jerry as my Mr. Miyagi and I'm the Karate Kid, he's really out there looking to see, hey, Brent, you know, move in faster, you know, watch behind you. Here's what I would do when it comes to the start. But what it feels like is you don't want to be comfortable, number one. We get strapped in that thing as hard as possible. So if you're comfortable, then the belts are too loose.
Yeah, you'll be moving around.
And then once you get out there, you know, you'll definitely feel some bumps. But when things are working right, it gets really calm and quiet.
Really?
Down the straightaway.
Because a jet ski hurts me. Like, I assume you'd be bouncing a lot harder than that.
You do.
That would be the corners.
Okay.
The corners. When you get into the corners, and Jerry, I'm not sure, you probably have the G-forces for our boat. But
well, no, most of the boats run about 2 or 3 Gs in the corner. And we have a shoulder pad and a wraparound seat and a head pad on the right side, because you get tossed over the right side of the boat so hard, you need something to keep you straight. We run a 468 blown alcohol Chevy, just like the dragster guys do, and they make a lot of noise, a lot of power, and accelerate. And if you imagine out on the race course, if you go to a drag strip, you see two cars go at a time, and that's how much noise you get out of two blown dragsters.
Yeah.
We're running 6 boats all down to the start, to the first turn, all side by side, and there's just a magic noise that you hear when all these 6 blower motors are all turned up making noise, and there's an echo that I just can't describe.
Speaking of echo, on Twitter right now at KUOW, Matthew asks, how loud is it? 6 boats, etc. How deafening is that for you?
It's interesting because with the adrenaline and everything going, you don't hear it as much. And then also we have earbuds in our ears, so it blocks out a lot of the noise. So I can
and
hear
the helmet
on the radio
too.
And the helmet. So
you know decibels?
I don't
think it's that loud. I mean, I can't hear anymore. Does that...
What'd you say?
But it's what? It's really not that loud. The pipes on the boat, they're just short little zoomy pipes, if people are familiar with the drag cars, and they are pointed back. So inside the boat, we've got the big firewall and the capsule that we're inside of, the helmet and the earphones, and it's not deafening.
Couple more questions. Jerry, is being 70 extra dangerous? Like broken bone risk or anything?
I think maybe to the other guys that want to win the race,
yeah,
might be a little risky for those guys.
Yep.
No, I don't. I guess where I'm comfortable is if the boat is doing what I want it to do, I'm okay with it. Just put the throttle down and go as fast as you can. We also, our left foot controls the front wing, and that helps, quote, fly the boat. So we can bring it up and bring it down, and I'm good with it.
All right. Brent,
yes.
Are you going to win this weekend?
Hey, we're going to give it our best, absolutely. We've got the right boat. We've got an amazing crew. There's a ton of horsepower in that brand-new motor of ours, so look out.
Any tips for the watchers?
For the watchers, just come join us. And I think the big thing for me is, and for Jerry as well, we want you to know the drivers. We want you to fall in love with the drivers. I mean, we're really working on resurging the sport. And I think that's something we need to do, is do radio interviews like this and get out and meet people. Whenever you come by our crew area, we're happy to introduce you and, you know, take you through the boat.
But do you have Brent Hall groupies?
I don't know. I guess.
I think I saw one at Pasco.
You might have. But what I would say is, you know, I really focus on connecting with the fans. So does Jerry. So if you're walking by and you're looking shy, it's like, hey, come over here. And especially the kids. There's nothing better than a kid walking 2 feet off the ground because he got to take a picture with you or talk to you. So we really engage a lot in Facebook. So that's a great way to contact us. Jerry Hopp.
Go to Jerry Hopp.
Yeah.
World's fastest grandpa. Right. You can Google that.
Maybe Brent could describe the name of the boat and where that came from.
Yeah, sure. So
actually, 30 seconds. Yeah, name of the boat.
Yeah. So Halsey Family Presents Miss Pignataro Boatschwagen. So we don't do this by ourselves. We've got amazing sponsors. One's just sponsoring and highlighting his family, and then Pignataro Volkswagen's been with us for years. I mean, they're just a great family member of Hopp Racing.
Teammates Brent Hall and Jerry Hopp, hydroplane racers you can wave at on Lake Washington. They may not be able to wave back if they're going into a turn. Straightaway right. Should be no problem. Seafair this weekend. Thanks to you both, and have a great time.
Oh, thank you. We really enjoyed it.
Turn up the boost. Turn up the noise. We bring the noise.
That's right.
KUW is the record. KUW is the record. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. The sky above Western Washington, we just looked at the water below. Above us, it is hazy in the even in the Puget Sound area because of all the fires burning in British Columbia. Joining us live now, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer's in Vancouver, where it is, nearing 90 degrees, I guess, Vaughn?
It's not our fault, the smoke, Bill.
Yeah.
Look at the Seattle Times today. The problem is the Pacific breezes didn't come through. They should be blowing, and they should be blowing the smoke back at us. So, yes, we're having one of the worst forest fire seasons in British Columbia in modern times.
Any idea why that is?
Very, very dry woods, a very dry winter, a lot of bad luck, a lot of careless people, a lot of forests that, you know, in the old days, the forests used to burn once in a while, and there wasn't an awful lot of buildup on the forest floor. So you throw all that in the mix, of course, climate change and global warming as well. But what it adds up to, Bill, is more forest area has been burned in British Columbia this year already than any time since the late 1950s. And in the late 1950s, we didn't have the kind of resources for fighting forest fires that we do today. We're bringing in people from all over North America. We've got people coming from Mexico to fight our fires. This weekend, we've got people from back east already. So this is, and it's still early in the season. August and early September are often the worst months.
Yeah, it's not just the interior. I see Vancouver Island, South Coast in fire danger. Washington State, fire season is not so bad yet. 10,000-acre fire south of Yakima, one on the west side here near Darrington, 160 acres or so. But I want to cover one more topic with you, Vaughn, because our president today said he wants to change the American immigration system to be more like Canada's, a merit-based system. How does that work?
The Canadian government essentially has a point system for people who want to immigrate to Canada. You can get points on the list if you have a skill that we're short of, engineering, technical skills. You can get extra points if you have a firm job offer. You can get points if you are a university graduate or a post-grad. You can also get points to come in if you're related to people who already live here. So you still have family reunification. We still have openings for refugees. And generally, the Canadian government has a pretty high target anyway for immigration, more than 300,000 people. It's seen as an economic development tool, particularly for attracting people from around the world who are well qualified for jobs. So it's a complex system. There isn't just one single way in, but generally it's a point system. The Canadian government decides who it wants, and it awards points in those categories to get them.
So in just 30 seconds, basically, how do Canadians like it? Is it popular?
Generally popular, generally supported in Canada. We're still a fairly small country in terms of population, so there's a feeling here that, you know, it is good for the economy. And, of course, we don't have the illegal crossing-the-border immigration problem that you do in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, big difference. Vaughn Palmer coming to us live from the Vancouver Sun. And hope those fires can get beaten back and everyone's as safe as possible. Vaughn, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
The record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle. We've got some immigration comparisons between the U.S. and Canada, and some other things to talk about now. The Affordable Care Act is something that Republicans just tried to repeal and failed. Now you've got members of the Republican-led Senate trying a new strategy, working with Democrats. So Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee, and our own Senator Patty Murray are going to start hearings in September to try to solve what they see as the biggest problem with President Obama's Affordable Care Act.
We have a number of counties across the country where insurance companies are not offering affordable plans or pulling out altogether. A lot of that is due to the uncertainty that they have been facing over the past year and not knowing what prices may be as a result of a lot of the actions that both Congress has been threatening and the president has been threatening. So those are the things that we need to address to begin with.
So what is your bipartisan fix?
So Senator Lamar Alexander and I are working on setting up a number of hearings very quickly in September to look at why those insurance companies are not going into some counties and how we can start stabilizing the market. We have both believed that part of it is the payments that the president needs to make, so that will likely be part of it, but we want to hear from the experts in the field to make sure the solutions that we move forward actually are going to help and make it a better marketplace.
Can Congress make the president make those payments to insurance companies?
Well, the interesting thing is that in the original Obamacare legislation, we provided that the president and his cabinet would make those payments. That's been challenged in a lawsuit, but the president can still make those. There's nothing saying he can't or shouldn't or anything like that. Congress does not have to act. But if he is refusing to do it and it is creating uncertainty, we can, in fact, act in September to force him to pay them through legislation.
We just saw how fractured the Republicans were over health care. Meanwhile, your Democratic colleague Bernie Sanders, or socialist colleague, is pushing a single-payer bill. A lot of Democrats think that's the answer. So how fractured are the Democrats?
Well, I think what we're all really united on right now is fixing the marketplace that is the immediate problem. obviously, there are a lot of ideas out there. I have talked a lot about having available a public option in all marketplaces. So at least one option is there, and it will help lower the cost. As you well know, others are talking about a lot of other solutions. But what we all agree on is that we need to have hearings. We need to understand what these costs are. We need to understand what the changes in the marketplace are. Where we make mistakes is just to make 10-second soundbite promises and then don't really do our homework behind them to help both us and the American public understand what is good about it or bad about it or the consequences to themselves. So as we move forward past the immediate issue of dealing with the market stabilization, which we need to do very quickly, I think it is important that we know the answers to those questions, and then whether we're united on is dependent on those answers.
You would like a public option for health insurance everywhere in America. What are the odds of that?
Well, in the short term, yeah. We're not going to focus on that. We're going to focus on market stabilization. Okay. Longer than that, I think it's a good option. But again, I want to hear from the experts on all sides to make sure that we are putting forward an issue that works. I think a marketplace public option would be good because I think it will help bring the cost down because it will provide more options for people, and the insurance companies will have to face that option. But, you know, I think there are other options as well, and I think that it's time for us to look at them.
On a different topic, Senator Patty Murray, today some Republican senators are with President Trump calling for a change in our immigration system, going to a merit-based system where you get points for speaking English and being educated, having a high-paying job offer and being young. That's basically how Canada does it. What do you think of it?
Well, I haven't seen the details of their plan, but my experience with this administration under Trump is they put out a lot of good words that sound nice, but the details are destructive. And I am very concerned that we move away from a system that makes sure that families can stay together, that people can come here and have the opportunity that many immigrants before have to make our country great again. And I would remind those senators, the Senate has passed bipartisan immigration that will work if we're allowed it to work. If we go down a party line conservative proposal, it won't pass and it won't help our immigration system. It is a system that needs to be fixed, but not in a partisan way.
I know you have to go, Senator. Final question. Meanwhile, back in Seattle, we just had an election, and Seattle's about to get its first woman mayor fall. Do you care?
Look, I'm excited when women can become strong role models in positions that help encourage young women across the board to be who they can be. So I think it's very exciting.
U.S. Senator Patty Murray joining us on a busy schedule as Congress pushes toward a recess. She works with Republicans planning hearings for September on improving the health care system we actually have. Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
And finally today, sending well wishes to McLemore, who got into a head-on collision on Whidbey Island. Reports are he is not seriously hurt and not at fault, though he was driving on a suspended license because of unpaid tickets. Not easy to get all your tickets taken care of when you're on a thrift store budget. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you tomorrow.